While it's very clear that professional pilots at the airline level, the corporate level, have established minimums under which they conduct their operations, in general aviation, not so much. How would you argue that we make this transition, you know, that works so well for the professionals to the general aviation realm? It's a big leap. A lot of folks don't do it and really don't understand personal minimums. Why are you such a advocate of personal minimums?
Well, I suppose it's because of my previous experience as an airline pilot, where we certainly had personal minimums when we were new on airplanes. We had personal minimums when we were new captains. And it simply recognizes the fact that one doesn't have a lot of experience in the area that you're operating in. Actually, we do have personal minimums in general aviation. When we're all student pilots, our instructor endorsed us to solo under only certain conditions, certain weather conditions, certain crosswind conditions. And without observing those, we couldn't fly. When we became private pilots, it now became our job to set our personal minimums. We had to decide how much crosswind we would accept or how low the ceiling would be if we chose to fly down to VFR minimums. And I don't think there's any difference as an instrument pilot, recognizing that we are low on experience and or conditions may be unsatisfactory, that we establish those kinds of minimums that will keep us safe. And we need to do that in an objective way, sitting at a table, not sitting in a cockpit.
Once again, when you get your instrument rating, the FAA certifies you as an instrument pilot. You can shoot approaches to minimums. That's what the FAA says. You can do it legally. How do you get from this broad approach down to specific minimums for Wally Moran or John Krug or anybody else?
I tell people about instrument flying that if you're flying around at 3,000 feet above the ground, you don't need to know where you are. There's not very much to hit up there. But as you get lower with that airplane, there are more and more things to hit, and you need to be more precise in your flying. And therefore, you need, when you have low experience, you need to set those minimums up a little bit to give you an opportunity to not be that precise and still be safe.
You said, that once you get your instrument rating, the FAA says you can shoot an approach to minimums. You can actually shoot an approach below minimums. I mean, there are no minimums to stop a Part 91 GA pilot. You can go out and shoot an approach if the airport's reporting 00. There's no, basically, you can take off 00. The FAA establishes nothing really at all, okay? But I just want to back up a little bit and talk about at least the way I looked at personal minimums and the way that I taught people. Is you have to look at it in a little bigger picture, okay? 502 for a precision approach is probably pretty good for someone who is, it's a good starting point anyhow for someone who is a fairly new instrument pilot. But 502 is not cookie cutter, okay? 502 for an ILS approach at a towered airport with a long runway is reasonable. 502 for a circling approach at night in a mountainous airport with a 3,000-foot runway is probably way too low. So you need to look at more than just the hard numbers. 502 to a runway that has a 90-degree crosswind may be below your minimum. So you need to look at it in a much, much larger picture.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, ever the contrarian here, I'm going to put out there that I actually don't like the idea of personal minimums in GA, and I don't like it for two reasons. One is, it's a variant on what you said, John. People tend to set personal minimums too high. But let me explain what I mean by that. If you have a personal minimum, you should be feeling uncomfortable as you approach that minimum. In other words, you shouldn't feel comfortable right up to your personal minimums, because what's going to happen is there's going to be a day when you need to go just past it. Maybe it was just 100 feet. Maybe it was just 50. But you were comfortable right up to the line. So it's very difficult to respect, even to just be slow on coming in on the throttle. That's a human nature. If your personal minimum is at a point, let's suppose you're very comfortable with 1,000 feet, ceilings, right? You know, you're shooting an approach out of the clouds, but it's not down. And you set your personal minimums down at 500, and that airport's reporting 7. Well, now you're already uncomfortable, right? You already know that you're approaching what you consider the limits of your ability, so that you will definitely respect that 5. The other danger of personal minimums, in my opinion, is we'll go out and say, well, my personal minimums are 502. And this gets even more to what John said. Well, 502 in what? And 502 since I flew when? Right? I mean, my personal minimum, when do I have to raise it? I didn't fly very much this month. So does that mean I need to raise my personal minimums? And to what? To 7? To 1,000? To 600? I have nothing to base that on other than almost throwing a dart at the wall. I prefer the idea of a personal standard, which is if I want permission to be able to fly an approach to whatever I decide I'm willing to go on that approach. So if it's an ILS, down to published minimum. If it's a circling approach at night, I'm going elsewhere, or, you know, it's kind of whatever I decide is appropriate for that situation. If I want permission to fly it to minimums, then I have to be maintaining a standard every time I fly of no more than, say, quarter scale deflection. And I'm testing the standard every time I fly. And if I'm going to fly an approach down, I'll fly it and I've got no more than quarter scale deflection. I broke out, I'm going to stay on that approach, right? I'm going to keep flying down. I have tested every time I go that I can maintain that level of skill. And that gives me the permission, in my opinion, to say, okay, on this one down to minimums, I've consistently demonstrated that skill. I can now apply it in this situation.
So how do you plan for that, though, before you take off? You still have to have some go, no-go indicators. And I think that's what Wally's point is that we don't know enough about what we don't know. So you have to start somewhere, and you work backwards from that.
So let me go right on to that. So in this situation, if there was going to be, you know, an instrument approach at is Gary, Indiana, right? No, he's going from Gary. Instrument approach at Dayton. Thank you very much. So if there's going to be an instrument approach at Dayton, this pilot would have to say, well, the last 5 approaches I shot, I had, you know, I was either needles locked in the center, no more than quarter scale. I'm on. I can fly that approach to minimums before takeoff. If he was like, I was having trouble on that last approach, it's off the table. Forget about personal. Forget about 500. You are operating outside standards that can have you safe on that approach. It's not even an option. But it's a different way of looking at it.
But we're not necessarily, as the pilot, equipped to make that decision. I think we need someone else to help us, take a look at our skills and help us.
I think we're missing the bigger point here. I think we're beating this personal minimums issue to death and failing to look at the bigger picture here, which involves the root cause of this whole problem, aeronautical decision-making and risk management, which starts before this whole flight is planned. It's no secret that the weather is going to be questionable on the day for the flight. So if this mission is so important and this type A personality is so committed to getting to this customer and making the presentation to sell equipment, then he should really be thinking about driving, going commercial, whatever other options are available versus taking his airplane in a condition where minimums are an issue, whether they be published minimums, personal minimums, whatever. Let's step back and look at this and think about the implications of weather and unforecasted weather. The weather could be worse, better, or the same as forecast. But whatever it is, there's an issue there. So if you're going to plan in terms of risk management, you say we're not going to fly on this particular day. We're going to get there in another way.
Let me raise a whole other issue here as I listen, I'm a strong believer in personal minimums myself. But how you arrive at them, I think, is kind of the essence of what I'm hearing here. So conceptually, good idea, but how do you get from A to B? Well, the whole concept of realistic training is what leaps into my mind, okay? If you have trained appropriately, I think then you are ready to execute. You know, you train. Are you training like you fight? Okay. I mean, and this is where I disagree with you a little bit, Jeff. You know, you say, okay, I did. I went out. I was great. But were you in the clouds? You know, could you look out the window? You know, they say a peak is worth a thousand cross checks. And that is so true. You know, inside a cloud, you know, we're dumber than dirt. And if you got mountains on both sides of you, you know, you start sweating. Mark, talk about realistic training. I mean, do we really go out and train in the weather so that we can fly in the weather? Or do we go out and train in good weather? Because none of us like to really fly in the clouds.
We train in good weather. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And having spent 20 years in Colorado, there isn't any bad weather that you can train in except about 2 weeks in June. And that's really about it. But the question that struck me as I was listening to Jeff and Wally talk about this is this concept that the pilot doesn't know what he doesn't know. And I don't have a problem with the answer that says, take a shot at flying the approach. But I agree with the answer that you don't do it in this situation. You have a pilot here who apparently has been flying by himself, has been lowering his own personal minimums as he goes along without his instructor's blessing, and has a pretty good idea of what his capabilities are. If he was alone without the pressures of the situation that make decision-making much more difficult and getting missionitis involved, then he might very well choose to fly this approach if he's on his own and take this opportunity to lower his personal minimums. But here, he's got employees, he's got a business commitment, he has someplace he has to be, and it's just the wrong time for him to do it.
And that goes back to that whole thing about the aeronautical decision-making that Bob was talking about. And I think the personal minimums, and maybe we're using a wrong word here but it's the criteria by which you evaluate the suitability of going on this flight. And all those the pressures that you were talking about, the aircraft, the weather, all of it needs to be kind of thrown into the hopper, and a go, no-go decision comes out of that.
Yeah, and to be clear, this may seem like backpedaling, but I want to be really clear on this. In this scenario, I would say you have to go to Muncie because you can't do a field promotion. You can't change your system based on the situation. I don't like the system. It's not the one I use personally or the one that I think is probably the most useful for people, but that's just a preference. If he's a personal minimums pilot, you can't change it in the field. You got to go to Muncie. And back to what Bob brought up, probably what you should have done was gone, it's going to be an approach at Muncie. You call everybody up, hey, we have to leave 2 hours early so we can intentionally land VFR. The rental car will be waiting for us and we'll drive the rest of the way. So you can still use the airplane. You don't have to drive partway. But okay, so fly to a VFR airport,
ultimately,
do a composite trip.
Ultimately, right? You would have come back to the same decision,
yes,
but arrived at it via a different path.
Route. Yes.
Yes.
I wanted to make that clear.
Okay.
I think I have a little bit of an issue with the concept of the pre-flight decision making. I think we have generally in general aviation a lot of emphasis on the initial go, no-go decision. And here what you really have is an in-flight, you know, keep mm-hmm. going or divert decision. And I think we spend a lot of time spending, you know, on the ground, make a decision. And I know that just in my flying, especially on trips with my wife in the other seat, I probably have some kind of a record of diverting as a general aviation pilot because of being unsure of what's ahead or whether I don't like up ahead. And I think what we have to be thinking more in terms of the training environment is how do you make this decision on a route when the pressures now already exist?
But this contingency that there's going to be an issue should not be a surprise. That's the point I was trying to make. So there does have to be some analysis prior to the flight, and maybe the decision is what Jeff had suggested. You fly to Muncie, you have a car waiting, and you jump in, and you've left earlier, so there's no impact on your arrival time at the customer. But that's got to be done, negotiated, worked out prior to getting in the airplane.
The decision to launch is not bad. The decision to continue on may be the decision that's bad. And if you launch with a contingency in mind and a suitable alternate plan, then there's no reason for taking off for an airport. You could take off for an airport that's below minimums, knowing that the forecast or the local conditions or whatever are going to be such that after a two-hour flight, you're going to get there and the weather's going to be better.
Right. You could go saying, my plan is to land at Muncie and my decision to divert is actually to go to Dayton because it was better than I expected. Sure. But, you know, that's not what happened here. And I think, you know, Mark brought up a great point. It's also why I hate the saying, plan the flight and fly the plan. What? You plan the flight and then you fly the flight because you just, you know, how many flights actually end up going exactly as you planned it? Almost none, right? So the skill is you plan the flight so that when you fly the flight, as few things as possible are a surprise, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I run into that all the time. There's always issues that come up. People are late. Weather's not what you planned. So there's always issues.
And I understand in this scenario, we've kind of got two options, you know. And you know, you could always stay home, don't launch at all. Well, that accomplishes nothing. The goal is to have this meeting. And so that's the goal. Don't lose sight of the goal. And you can safely accomplish that by going to Muncie.
Well, maybe or maybe not. You might be too late for the appointment.
But let me just throw out and ask, I mean, is there anything inherently dangerous about going to Dayton, shooting an approach to minimums for a qualified pilot? Does that add risk to this flight? I understand we can divert, but is it risky or dangerous for a qualified pilot to shoot an approach to minimums if the visibility and standards are met, you land? If not, you do a go-around, which is well within safety parameters. Jeff?
That's, I think, where I was getting to with this concept of personal standards. If that is what you fly by, if you say, you're saying, is it inherently dangerous? If all the information I have on previous flights, on practice flights, sure, they were in visual conditions with a hood on, that's the best I could do. It's the best information I have. If everything I have says I can meet a standard of performance that lets me get to a 200-foot DA centered where I'm supposed to be consistently, then it is no more dangerous for me because I have less time than if it is somebody else who has more time. We're performing to this standard.
I disagree.
Good.
Respectfully. I think when we talk about shooting an approach to the minimum, that is the very minimum given whether it's a precision or a non-precision. The FAA did the TERPS measurements, and they determined that you could safely descend to this altitude and get out of there, providing you can navigate precisely and you operate precisely. And I think it is more dangerous to be at those minimums, whatever they are, because your opportunity for error, your ability to have an error and survive is much smaller than if you are somewhere above those minimums. You just simply can make mistakes and still survive and or have equipment malfunctions and still not get in trouble.
I totally agree with that, that shooting an approach that is IMC to decision altitude is inherently more risky just because you are closer to the ground than shooting an approach to 500 feet or 1,000 feet and then being visual. You know, so if we're comparing whether it's more dangerous to fly to minimums or more risky, it'd be a better word, than flying to a higher level, then yeah, I mean, you're closer to objects. You have less time to recover. You have less time to deal with an equipment failure, all those things. What I'm saying is, when you respectfully disagreed, what I'm saying is two pilots who are showing equivalent levels of performance coming down to minimums, they both can do it to the same level of performance. I'm going to say that the difference between the pilot who's done it 1,000 times and the pilot who's done it 100 times is marginal at best. If they both can do it, they both get there, you know, there's a maybe a small gain of experience over here having dealt with a nav flag or something, but, you know, they're both operating to that standard.
Have we given the private pilot that's out there that says, the FAA says I can legally fly this approach to minimums today, tomorrow, I'm qualified. I have an instrument rating right here. I can do it. How do we get from the authorization and the legality to do it to the decision whether or not we do that? And that's the answer. That's the trail we need to leave with the private pilot. We talked about realistic training. We talked about personal minimums. We talked about risk assessment. Some of these concepts are well understood by general aviation pilots. Some of them are still way out there in left field. How does the general aviation pilot that, you know, hasn't wrapped his hands around this says, I'm a certified instrument pilot, I can do it, and make him the pilot that says, yeah, I can, just because I can doesn't mean I should.
Well, when we obtained our instrument rating and demonstrated our ability to fly approaches safely to the minimums, did that after some rather intense period of practice and training. And most garden variety instrument pilots aren't maintaining that level of intensity with their practice and training. As the airlines and the military and the corporations do, they get intense training on a regular basis. We, as general aviation pilots, we make that decision on our own whether we're going to take the training or not. And I think that has to be one of the major factors we have to factor into our decision-making as we make that go-no-go decision.
And that goes back to what Jeff's talking about, too, is that continuous self-evaluation. Mm-hmm. Okay, just because you've fulfilled the legal requirements and you've got your six approaches and, you know, all that, were those quality approaches or were they done under the hood? You know, what was your tolerances during that? What was the conditions? And how do you realistically evaluate yourself? And that's really a key there.
I think, you know, when it comes to the regulations and what they require, there's a truism that is what's legal isn't necessarily safe. Right. And, you know, the FARs are replete with minimum requirements that are such bare minimums. If you haven't flown at night for 4 years, three stop and goes at your local airport is not an excuse to take your family on an overnight trip. As you mentioned already, the question of instrument currency, you can be instrument legally current by having your autopilot fly six approaches at your home airport without ever having to look at it or brief an approach because you know it like the back of your hand. And I think that's something that really has to be imposed and really taught to students at every and pilots at every level, even at discussing at flight reviews and IPCs, is that don't look at the FARs and their requirements as some indication of proficiency. It's simply an indication of legality.
You mentioned bringing your family along on this hypothetical night flight. Well, that brings up the issue of the gravity of this whole situation increasing because you have three passengers on board the airplane that need to be considered as well. So it's not only you, the pilot, making this trip, it's you and three passengers.
And it's entirely possible, to go back where Wally was talking about, just to throw another thing in, that if this was a commercial flight, if this was a 135 operator,
it would not go.
The pilot may not have 100 hours in type and would be legally barred from completing
this
flight.
Well, and only certain single-engine airplanes are capable of
135. Even assuming it was a twin or, I mean, even if it was a jet or whatever, this pilot may not have 100 hours in it.
You know, we've talked all around this subject, but I think we all agree realistic standards that are regularly validated will allow us to operate safely, and in a situation just like this, make the appropriate decision.